Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be trying to discuss this question. Should university professors, or perhaps any kind of teacher, be free to bring their personal political beliefs into the classroom? Now, depending upon who you ask, you might get a variety of answers. Some people would say the answer clearly should be yes, and that academic freedom demands that. The teachers are entitled to freedom in discussing their subject. Others might give a qualified yes. They might say, well, yes, as long as all points of view are given equal time. And I suppose there are people who would, in fact, argue that politics have no place at all in the classroom. In this art of the show, we'll talk about this issue, and we have two guests, both of them from the University of Illinois. Matthew Finken, he is professor of law, and Brian Gaines, he is associate professor of political science. And in addition, Matthew Finken was a member of a committee that just has recently, about a month or so ago, released a report. This was a committee of the American Association, of university professors? This was something that certainly has caused some discussion within academic circles about this very question, that is, political views in the classroom. Also, for people who might be here in and around Champaign-Urbana, one of our guests, Brian Gaines, will be taking part in a conversation on the subject politics in the classroom, bias, academic freedom, and student learning, and this will take place next Tuesday, the 23rd, over the noon hour in 319 Gregory Hall. And one of the panelists here will be Carrie Nelson from English here at the U of I, who was also on the same committee that Matthew Finken was on, this AAUP committee. Questions here, welcome, certainly. We'd like to get people who are listening involved in the conversation. So if you would like to give us your thoughts, you can do that by giving us a call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We just ask people who call, however, to be brief so that we can keep our conversation moving and get in as many people as possible. But certainly, questions, comments from listeners are welcome. Thank you both very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
I appreciate it. I don't know if this is too flat out to ask the question, but I guess I'll do that, and then we can see if we can take it apart a little bit more. Is it appropriate, and I'll ask Professor Finken first, and then Professor Gaines, you can give me your thoughts too. Is it appropriate for an instructor, university professor, to express his or her personal political views in the classroom?
Well, I guess my answer is the qualified one. We don't write on a clean slate here. The question is goes back really in the United States, perhaps 150 years, the days of Henry Tappan and his presidency at the University of Michigan. The academic profession came to agreement on the standards of academic freedom in the classroom in a document called the 1940 Statement of Principles, which has now been endorsed by, I think, 230 educational organizations and disciplinary societies. And that document says that a professor should have freedom in discussing his subject matter in the classroom, that the professor should eschew the persistent intrusion of irrelevant material. So if political, and that's quite a freighted term, what is political, if political views are germane to the subject, then I think a professor is privileged to discuss it in connection with the subject. A professor is not privileged to demand acceptance by students of the professor's position on controverted questions, mm-hmm. but to assay controverted questions and in so doing to indicate the students where the instructor comes out on them is traditionally been viewed as exercise of freedom in the classroom.
So this, and when you talk about a person in expressing their views in their subject, so very clearly now do we set aside something where, just to give a bald-faced example, you would say a math professor who stood in front of the classroom and talked to him about his feelings about the Bush administration, you would say this is not what we're supposed to be doing here. The math professor's there to teach mathematics, and that you would say, would you say that that was not appropriate?
Yes, I would say the injection of partisan politics into the mathematics plays no role. But in many of the social sciences and humanities, it's hard to extract a particular topic from a political matrix in which it might be embedded. There's a group, for example, Students for Academic Freedom, a bit of a misnomer, who said that if your course is not about President Bush, you can't mention the name of President Bush. This is in a statement they issued. And it was an op-ed piece in the New York Times that said that if you're teaching Moby Dick, could you compare President Bush to Captain Ahab? I think that that's an exercise of academic freedom. It draws the students into the subject by reference to contemporary personalities. I don't view that as politicizing the course. I think that that's simply good pedagogy.
Well, let me here turn to Brian Gaines and say here, now in your field, political science, one can't hardly avoid talking about politics.
You certainly can't avoid talking about politics, but it isn't necessarily the job of a political science professor to make his or her own views known. And I think in a good course in the presidency, it should be possible to teach a class in the presidency without revealing whether you think President Bush is a good or a bad president. It's not the only way to teach the presidency. I wouldn't say it's inherently inappropriate to reveal your own views on the president. But I think it isn't clearly the best way to teach the presidency to be announcing your own views. Mm-hmm. Students are fairly good, I think, at parroting the views of a professor if they sense that that's going to be to their own benefit. I think possibly some of the worry about indoctrination takes it a little too seriously, because I think what might pass as indoctrination is students wise enough to know that a particularly slanted professor will reward the students who parrot his views, and they'll do so without changing their minds. That would be, in general, I think a rather poor class. To back up from this slightly, the controversy arose from the question of whether or not people are getting balance. If a student taking political science classes only ever hears the left-wing view in the classroom, this is the sort of allegation people have made, that there isn't enough balance, and then incumbent on the professors not only to present their own views, present both sides. I think ordinarily most of the time most people would agree that's pretty good pedagogical practice, that most interesting questions in political science, probably in law as well, have more than one side. It's not terribly interesting to say, in my view, this president is good or bad for these reasons. Now let's move on.
Well,
take the Moby Dick example. In some respects, that's more interesting. We're clearly not talking about teaching of linear equations or fluid mechanics. If you're doing a conversational German class and you choose to make all the conversations about politics, you're probably not doing your job well. But if you're talking about one of the examples in the AAUP literature was Macbeth. Should a professor, and it's not unlike the Moby Dick example, should they be free to compare Macbeth to George Bush? I think they should be free. I'm not sure it's a great teaching technique. Macbeth is a fascinating thing to teach insofar as students might differ on their interpretation of Macbeth without comparing him to contemporary figures. As soon as you've said, let's think about Macbeth as Rod Blagojevich or Bill Clinton or George Bush, the controversies that will ensue will largely be about whether the students agree with the professor's characterization of Blagojevich, Bush, or Clinton. So in some respects, I think bringing politics into humanities is occasionally a useful device, but it's probably more often a distraction and not a great technique. Mm-hmm.
I don't disagree. The question is I don't hear that it's simply impermissible or out of bounds. The question is what references advance the purpose of the class and what don't. And I agree that students today you can't fool them. They know when they're being flim-flammed. The brouhaha that's been stimulated seems to me to be really much of a tempest in a teapot.
Well, let me set up this hypothetical. Supposing that you have someone who is teaching constitutional law and who stands in front of the classroom and says that the position that the Bush administration has taken on the issue of presidential power and this expansive view of presidential power is antithetical to the intention of the framers who set up these three co-equal balancing branches of government. And in fact, I think that the administration in its effort to enlarge the power of the presidency is damaging the Constitution of the United States. Would you have any problem with a professor saying that?
No.
And
I don't think an exam question would be framed, tell me the five reasons why this is the worst administration in living memory, or, you know, that's indoctrination. But in law, certainly, and the kinds of questions you raise, it may be that a professor wishes to maintain a studied agnosticism. This is the arguments, and that may be good pedagogy for some students, but for others, they would want to know, well, what do you think? And there's nothing wrong with a professor saying what his opinion is, so long as we understand that these are controverted questions and that the student is not held to account to agreement with the professor's opinion on that.
Well, you might in a political science classroom, you might be discussing the same thing. How would you feel about a professor saying, you know, I think that, again, say the Bush administration and this approach to enlarging presidential power, I think it's doing something damaging to the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting and arguable point, and it's something a professor might well advance. It would be a better course, and I think if I were in the position of evaluating the teacher, I would regard it as better teaching if the professor said, there's another view on this. Here's arguments on the other side. And it doesn't mean that professors are hamstrung into a kind of neutrality. They're not allowed to say, I find these arguments stronger, or most of the discipline actually favors this position, and here's the reason why. To make this other argument, you really have to go through some hoops and barrels. Mm-hmm. But, I think it's not so much a question of whether there's some sort of clear, rigorous requirement of balance in every presentation, but whether students are getting sort of multiple sides most of the time. And I think, why we're talking about this today is because there are a set of people out there complaining that most of the time in the classroom, students don't get – there's not enough a presentation of both sides.
Yeah. Well, and let's be clear, it seems to me that mostly what this is people who are politically conservative who are saying that that most of the time students are not getting a complete set of views, and that conservative viewpoints are generally not reflected in the class.
They're armed with some very strong circumstantial evidence at the outset that almost virtually all the surveys of ideology and partisanship of professors show. Professors don't align with the general public. They're much too liberal. They're much too democratic. Democratic in capital D sense compared to the general public. It's more true in the humanities and the social sciences than it is in business or even the natural sciences, where it's largely innocuous if what you're teaching is acids and bases. It doesn't matter what your views are. So, as I say, it's entirely circumstantial. It might well be that liberal Democrats are very good at presenting both sides, as good or better than the conservative Republicans. But there are far more liberal Democrats. So in the aggregate, if people's views are seeping into the classroom, the claim is it must be the liberal democratic view that's heard most often.
And Professor Fried, you don't see it that way?
Well, this is an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, the surveys that were done by Seymour Martin, Lipset, and Everett Ladd in the 60s of the political views of the faculty showed that about 5.2% considered themselves ultra-left, and there was a bell curve, and most were considered themselves middle of the road, not a majority, but a plurality of fact. The most recent survey indicates a shift to the left by about 2% vis-a-vis 1965. Now, Bob Post at Harvard and I have speculated on what this really means. I mean, it may be that the American professoriate has stood where it has stood more than 40 years, and the country's moved to the right. I mean, one could look at the Republican platform circa 1965 and the last election and see whether, that the professoriate's pretty much stood where it has. Another useful question that has opened up is, that the faculties, particularly in perhaps in the humanities, social science. I don't know about the hard sciences. Business schools, there are subsets of data. How would one compare that, for example, to the political views of the military or the police forces? I mean, is there something about the academic life that attracts a certain kind of mind, or personality that's different from other walks of life? That may have some powerful explanatory power. What has not been documented, I think, is the claim made by certain elements of the right that persistent indoctrination is a characteristic of the modern, at least of the large research university or selective liberal arts college. There have been 21 bills introduced around the country to try to legislate in this matter, and hearings have been held in many of these states, Colorado, I know, Pennsylvania, most extensively. not a single case of what I think the profession would readily recognize as indoctrination, as wrongful conduct, conduct not protected by academic freedom, has been identified. So I'm skeptical of the validity of the claim and certainly of the need for any legislation in this regard.
We have a couple of callers here, and I want to get to them, and I hope that they wouldn't mind just waiting 1 minute further, because I want to ask Brian Gaines, you know, there are certainly people who have this concern about the liberal professoriate can come up with anecdotal examples that will help them make their case. And I'm not saying that they're right or that they're not. I guess I'm wondering what you think, though, about the fact that then from that people go to say, you know, I have these 10 examples or these 5 examples and argue from that says something about all university professors as a group or all colleges, that there is this sort of sweeping liberal bias in the professoriate and that there is indeed a lot of indoctrination going on in the classroom. Do you think that that's the case?
Do I think there's a lot of indoctrination? I think I'd say the jury's out to some extent. I think the anecdotes, you know, I would certainly agree the case is not to be made. And the anecdotes, when they're the really juicy anecdotes, are generally cases that have come to light and in some manner been corrected. And the most juicy anecdotes are people who are professors actually using or requiring students to engage in political activity, which is illegal in Illinois for everybody doing the ethics test this month will be reminded they're not supposed to be engaging. They're not permitted to engage in partisan activity within the classroom. Mm-hmm. Those cases are pernicious and they're very rare. And so I think they're not really the interesting things to talk about. I think more the circumstantial evidence about, well, you know, on balance, these professors admit they're liberal and conservative. They're more liberal and conservative. They're more Democratic than Republican. If their own views seep into the classroom in a subtle way, they must be gently nudging the students to the left. That's a very difficult thing to prove or disprove. It's probably much less disturbing than the idea that there's a brainwashing going on where students only ever hear one side. I think conscientious teachers, most often their own views, even in a political science course, their own views don't come up. And in a course on public opinion, the point in studying why the public changes its opinion on the death penalty or abortion is not to begin with the position I hold is the following, and that's why this is the right one and the public's moving away from me or towards me. But to study in broad terms, what can we figure out what sort of social forces propel people to move one way or another? Why is it that there's a difference across generations in attitudes of this sort? So I'm optimistic on balance that the strong claims of indoctrination are greatly exaggerated. I'm not so sure that there isn't a subtler sort of the tilt that we just see in the raw survey data doesn't show up somehow in the classroom.
We have some callers here. I want to bring them into the conversation. I would like again to introduce our guest, Brian Gaines. He is Associate Professor of Political Science here at the University of Illinois. He's also affiliated with the university's Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Matthew Finken is Professor of Law. He's Director of the Program in Comparative Labor and Employment Law Policy at the U of I and was a member of this committee. As I mentioned at the beginning, there has been this committee of the American Association of University Professors looking at this issue of politics in the classroom did issue a report about a month ago. It is available on the web if you would like to take a look at it. And also, Brian will be taking part in a group conversation on the subject, politics in the classroom, bias, academic freedom, and student learning. This will take place next Tuesday over the noon hour in 319 Gregory Hall. And also involved in that will be Carrie Nelson, professor of English here at the U of I, who was, along with Matthew Finken, one of the people who was on this AAUP committee that produced this report. We have some callers here, and we want to get them in here. Again, though, people can help us by trying to be brief, just so that we can accommodate as many calls as possible and keep moving. So, with that, we'll start in and talk with someone on a cell phone on our line for the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Great discussion. I love the political sciences. I need to get back into this. I'll tell you, recently, I've come across a few people that, and myself included, I'm going back to school. And I'm 51 years old. Now, I have a degree in forestry, but even when I went back in the 70s, the late 70s, when I got this, put back then, it seemed to me most professors and most instructors were of to the left nature. And I just basically just recently found out, now I've been doing studying this stuff, and I don't know if you studied this, a lot of these professors are in administration is to the left for one reason, and one reason only, because the federal government has funds or funding, or certain people have funding that is wrapped around some of the projects. For example, they're mad at the right because of the cell. I'm trying to remember. Excuse me, I get a mind blank here. Some of the medical fields they're trying to stem cell research. They're trying to do this, and the professors in certain schools don't like being told they can't research it. Basically, it's like cutting the hand to feed them. If they say something bad, I guess that's what I'm trying to get to. If they say something bad and go against the grain, they might be reprimanded, so to speak, as far as funding, lack of funding. And I find that more happens to the left than to the right. But there is no fair and balanced out there. I mean, I've been to a couple of classes and a couple of schools in my lifetime, and I got to tell you, I've never heard once where somebody didn't pose their point of view or try to one way or the other instead of just giving a neutral outlook on it, because I think it's human nature to begin with. But I'm just wondering, is that the case? I mean, does funding have something to do with it?
Well, okay. It does. I thank you for the comment. I don't know if either of you wanted to take on that question.
I'll let Brian take a shot.
Okay. Do you think that somehow funding has a way of pushing people or institutions in particular directions politically?
Well, I would certainly agree that professors are self-interested, and insofar as there's research money that will be flowing to their funding their own researches, they strongly advocate for it, and they greatly believe that more of it should be done. And I don't know that it. I don't think that's a great explanation for why professors turn out to be more, on balance, more to the left, because there's more funding. I mean, this, you know, the military funds lots of research, and it might well be in the self-interest of professors of various kinds to be all in favor of greater spending on larger military budget, because it's going to turn into research dollars. So, I'm certainly sympathetic to the idea that professors are fond of getting more money from the government, not less. I don't think that is a key explanation for why it is that their views tend to skew to the left slightly.
The caller is actually raising a different but nonetheless pressing question, and that is, whether the research funding of universities, the federal government is the largest, I think, funder, but there's private corporate-sponsored research has been rising, and whether the research agendas of persons or entities outside the university view what the university does. And the answer to that, I think, obviously, is yes. And then the question is, how badly does it skew? How deeply does it entrench upon the autonomy of the institution to decide what is valuable work worth doing in the area of commercialization of research, whether the university is diverting resources from fundamental discovery, which has been the earmark of the United States since the end of the Second World War, into more commercial application, which may have short-term payoffs, particularly as universities may now themselves commercialize the product of this research, but deter research from the really kind of breakthrough. Basically, these are very serious questions, but they're not questions of politicization in the classroom. They're questions of the skewing of the research mission of the institution.
Mm-hmm. There's a parallel topic. We're talking about academic freedom, and academic freedom applies both in teaching and in the own research. And then the statement that the AAUP recently drafted was about academic freedom in the classroom, which is sort of distinct from academic freedom, where you're being pressured to do research of a certain kind or diverted from research you'd rather do by political pressure.
All right. Well, again, thank the caller. I have some other folks here who have been very patient, and let's get on to the next. And this would be someone in Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I suppose an interesting question would be, why do these presumably quite intelligent people tend to be aligned with the left? But that's not my question. How do you feel about the expression of personal opinion outside the classroom, because that seems to have become an issue quite recently. And yes, I'm thinking of Professor Finkelstein.
Well, actually, that's from the point of view of the doctrine of academic freedom, that's a very interesting question. The profession came to agreement in 1940 that as a citizen, a professor was not held accountable to his or her employing institution. That a professor, now some have argued that really shouldn't be considered as a matter of academic freedom at all, simply as a matter of normal civil liberty. The problem is that employees in the private sector have no civil liberties when it comes to speech, and employees in the public sector have a rather cribbed version of First Amendment rights. So the way this plays out, and this is a very different argument, is that somehow professors have made and successfully gotten institutional acceptance of the idea that there is no institutional censorship when the professor speaks, not as a professor, but simply as a member of the body politic. But that is the accepted wisdom. Now, I would defend that, by the way, on the basis that Abbott Lawrence Lowell did, president of Harvard many years ago, that if an institution censures what a faculty member says in his capacity or her capacity as a citizen, then the institution will tacitly have condoned whatever a faculty member says that the institution doesn't censor. Once you assume responsibility for speech uttered as a citizen, you are responsible for all speech uttered as a citizen. No university wants to put itself in that position. And so a self-denying ordinance that abjures the institution's responsibility so long as a faculty member is not speaking in his capacity as a faculty member but as a citizen, I think is the responsible and correct result. Brian, you?
The one thing I'd weigh in, I guess I've added this, I think almost everybody on all sides in this debate agrees that universities ought to be places which are full of broad-ranging debate. Outrageous ideas can be expressed on universities, much more so than in public or private corporations. So the question about how professors ought to behave in the classroom is certainly distinct from what they ought to be able to put in the writing, what they can say at any other venue. And I don't sense from left or the right any strong desire to censor professors and really to clamp down on free speech on universities.
Although that does seem to be what happened to Professor Finkelstein.
Well, his case, of course, his case has now been settled.
Yes.
So it isn't a live case, but it was not, there was a dispute over the quality of his research, the quality of his scholarship. I don't think it was his extramural expression. I think there was a dispute about what he said in his books.
Yes, but I don't think it would have come up had it not been for what he said.
Well, now we're on that slippery slope of when, if a professor of chemistry, we'll take the Northwestern case, professor of engineering, of civil or chemical engineering, wrote a book denying the Holocaust. Is he wearing his hat as a faculty member, in which case you're held to a professional standard of care? And I don't think anyone would say that by any exercise of a professional standard of care is it defensible to claim that the non-historicity of that event. Or was he wearing his hat simply as a citizen? Any citizen can get a soapbox, stand in front of the state capitol and say the Holocaust never existed. We don't sanction that. So we do bifurcate the capacity in which the faculty member speaks. That may be a tenuous bifurcation. There are problems with it. But that's the way we've looked at this problem for a long time.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Just forgive me for going back a couple of steps, but I did want to ask Professor Finkin, just going back to the earlier hypothetical about the constitutional law professor who wants to talk about the Bush administration and its approach to presidential power. And you said, you know, if that person wants to say, I believe this is a threat to the it's damaging to the Constitution of the United States and runs counter to what the founders had in mind with balance of powers. If a professor of constitutional law would say that, you would say, well, that's okay. I've got no problem with a statement like that. Would you, though, go a step further and say that person, while it would be okay to make that statement, that somehow it's incumbent upon them to say, but there are other constitutional scholars who would take a different point of view, they wouldn't have a problem with this, and here's what they say.
Well, you know, the question, how does that statement arise? I teach labor law, and labor law is still a highly controverted and hotly contested area. Now, in teaching the National Labor Relations Act, we have a board that's appointed by this president. The board has been making a number of very interesting decisions in terms of how they pair up with the statute or its own precedent. Now, my function is not simply to say, I think, to anatomize the board's decisions and its dissents. Many of these are 3-2 decisions split between the Republican majority and the Democratic minority. My function is not, you know, simply to lay out the theory advanced by each and unpack their assumptions and their faithfulness to the history and text of the statute in the contemporary economic circumstances. I could do that. I could choose to teach that way. But am I free to say, as between these two, I think the better view is one or the other? Well, I think I'm free to form an opinion. I've got 30 years of research, publication, teaching, and, you know, the students, I think, would expect to know how the professor comes out. I can deny them. I can say, no, you make up your own mind. And I do that on occasion. But there are other occasions when I say, well, I think this is the better view. I do not hold students to account to my view on this. That, I think, would be indoctrination. But I think I'm certainly privileged to tell them that what I think the soundness of one reasoning, that's the nature of all legal education. My professor was Clyde Summers at Yale, and someone asked him about value-free instruction in law school, and he said, look, law school is simply not target practice for hired guns. I think students, there are professors in my field, and I can name several, who believe that there's an undue incursion on management rights. My own view, I think, is that this board has been eroding too deeply into employee rights. I would certainly advert to work contrary to my own opinion, but it's my academic freedom in the classroom to express that opinion.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, is that, are you okay with that, or do you still have some sort of feeling that says that you're, as a professor, that you're, even if the students really want to know, okay, well, Professor Gaines, what do you, you know, whatever it is you're thinking about, they want to, well, what do you think? I mean, do you, would you then say, well, okay, I'll tell you what I think, but this is just what I think, or would you tend to back off and say, well, you know, I can tell you what a lot of different people think, but I don't want to lay out this set of views and say, this is me personally, this is what I think.
I don't have a one-size-fits-all answer, I guess. I'm not 100% sly and coy in the classroom, so I refuse ever to admit what my own preferences are. I think in a lot of the topics, it's not what I'm talking about in teaching, say, a public opinion class is not my own opinions aren't relevant, whether I approve or disapprove of George Bush. If I want to study presidential approval, I just want to understand the American public's approval, not my own. If I were talking about a court case, if it was talking about voting rights and Reynolds v. Sims came up, and I could say, here's a case that profound implications for the way the state legislatures are set up. 7-1 decision, there's only one dissent. I find the dissent very compelling. I might well say that. But it's not something that it certainly isn't something where the answer of an exam question would be, tell me why Reynolds or Simmons was a bad decision and why Professor Gaines is correct that state senates shouldn't have been forced to become one person, one vote. And I think people collecting anecdotes about outrageous professors' behavior tend to find people who really view it, sort of announce a political position stridently throughout a classroom, throughout a semester in the classroom. And I don't doubt there are people out there like that, but I think it's almost invariably a poor teaching technique.
Yeah. Well, Professor Finken, it sounds like you would probably agree with Brian.
Absolutely.
It says, well, yes, that's a poor teaching technique. But then would you say, though, at the end of the day, though, if we're really going to be faithful to the principle of academic freedom, we might have to say, yeah, we think that person's not a good teacher, but we're going to defend his or her right to do that?
What's the that?
To be up front and center to advance a political viewpoint.
Well, I don't know about – look, if I'm studying someone who is an avowed – under someone who is an avowed Marxist, I mean, would we appoint Karl Marx to a position in political economy? I assume if we did. I certainly have written a lot, you know. I imagine he'd be pretty interesting in the classroom. I would not expect him to espouse a neoclassical view, but he certainly would anatomize it, would he not? I mean, I have no problem with that. The question, as Brian said, is a fine line. Is are alternative views accepted? Are they welcomed? Are they encouraged? Is the professor insisting upon acceptance of his or her perhaps idiosyncratic view as a condition of a grade? The latter is plainly forbidden. I think the former, simply approaching a subject matter from a particular perspective that is upfront with the students, is concordant with what universities should be doing.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some more folks here. Let's go to line two. They're next in line in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, first of all, that I haven't heard a discussion of this subject before where I am sympathetic to both of the conversationalists, so that's really a pleasure. But I think both people are taking reasonable positions. And I guess in full disclosure, I should say that I was also on the subcommittee that drafted the AAUP report. I wanted to give an example and then pose a question to Brian. It seems to me often that we try to prejudge what would or would not be good pedagogy, and that it's really very difficult to do that in advance of a circumstance, and it's difficult for someone not in the classroom to judge it. The example came up of a math professor. Would it be appropriate to bring politics into a math classroom? And I would have said probably not, until I met a math professor a couple of months ago who said that he likes to use contemporary examples to bring mathematics home to his students. And at the moment, many of his examples come from the Iraq War. And part of what he points out is that body counts in the Iraq War, like those in Vietnam, that fought public opinion surveys in Baghdad, a whole series of mathematically relevant practices of the military aren't very reliable. So in effect, he's saying military math is to math the way military music is to music. And therefore, in a sense, he doesn't make a judgment about the Iraq War, but you could say that he's casting doubt on the veracity of the spokespeople for the military based on the kind of math that they do for some of their accounts. And, you know, when the Iraq War comes to an end, he'll probably stop using those examples because the students will rapidly forget about it. But there's a case where, you know, his math classroom, his introductory math classroom, has a wide variety of contemporary political references in it because he thinks, out of his own pedagogical beliefs, that that makes for relevant teaching that interests his students. So my question for Brian is, would go something like this. If you agree, and I agree, that there should be a lively debate on campus about what makes for good teaching and what doesn't make for good teaching, in the end, so long as the faculty member believes that political issues are germane to the subject the way he or she is teaching it, should it in fact be that individual faculty member's decision about how to deploy them in the classroom?
Well.
Let me take the easiest part first and agree that we don't have an iron law of pedagogy that we know exactly what works best. And I think nobody is likely to try to enforce any sort of rule on professors what sort of examples they can use. A math professor can do examples that were from his notes from 20 years ago, and he's just too lazy to brush them up. He can do anything he can to engage students, more the better. Let me answer in a slightly circuitous way. I have colleagues who work on ethnic violence, and they write down mathematical models of violence. And frequently you see them falling into what I think of as the economist trap. They have a tin ear for what sounds grossly offensive. So they have a model, and they're talking about slack, and they're talking about the optimal rate of murder or something, or the ideal dictator who optimizes terror so that he can get just the right number of murders to keep the people in check. And you have to stop these people and say, this is extremely important and emotional material. You can't present it in quite such a dry way. And then they catch themselves and they say, well, there's a slack condition. So if you're creating the right number of genocide facilities. So, I worry about people picking examples poorly in this case or not hearing what they're saying. I guess my plot with the math professor is, it might actually be a distraction in presenting a course on combinatorics and how to count things if every example you come up with is an example that also serves the purpose of criticizing the military or announcing to the class that you're opposed to the war. It might turn out to be a good way to engage students and to keep them interested in what is otherwise dry math.
Examples. Yeah, he doesn't exclusively those examples.
Well, I wouldn't object. And I guess the other question that comes up is, how are these things ever going to be enforced? The truth is, once you have tenure, there isn't a police force that checks in on each classroom.
They've set one up at Penn State. Penn State now, just this past year, this year actually, adopted a practice whereby any student who feels that a political comment in the classroom is inappropriate can report it to the administration, and that is supposed to trigger an investigation of the classroom comment.
Well, notwithstanding that example, I think in general what's going to happen is people who are untenured will have their teaching evaluated, and mm-hmm. it will play a role. And people who are tenured are on a very long leash to do whatever they like with their examples. We can sort of make abstract claims about what's good or bad pedagogy, but for all the uproar and so on, very few people are going to be – who have already got tenure are going to be disciplined. So mostly what we're talking about is how is the evaluation of people who are untenured going to proceed, and will their being politicized or politicizing the classroom being perceived to have done so, will that enter into the decision?
Mm. Well, just real quick, I have other callers here, but let me ask the caller, do you think that somehow there is, because of this prevailing atmosphere, that there is some danger that there will be a stifling of academic freedom or professors feeling free to teach in the way that they like in the classroom?
Well, Matt brought up the example of the legislation that we've seen over the last couple of years. A bill failed in the Arizona legislature that would have fined faculty members $500 for every inappropriate political remark in the classroom. It failed. On the other hand, a bill passed the Missouri House that asked the Missouri Institutions of Public Education to report every year on their success at balancing faculty appointments between those who believe in evolution and those who believe that the Bible is accurate and cannot be in error. And they also asked the universities to report on whether they had distributed funds on campus equally according to those two beliefs, and whether course instruction balanced those two beliefs. I thought the bill was a joke, but it passed the Missouri House, and then the AAUP got very active in defeating it in the Missouri Senate. I'm not even sure where you would find too many biologists who would believe that evolutionary theory was completely wrong. But so given that legislative agenda that even though it's failed, but it's failed in part because it's been fought aggressively, I do think that there is a risk.
Mm. And I want to thank you for the comments. And before I go on to somebody else here, just I want to go back to Brian and say, just to what extent do you think that there is that there is this kind of risk? Or is it just that, yes, you can't deny that there are certain places where these things have happened. We have to acknowledge that, yes, in fact, it has happened, but that it's not something that's a large-scale threat to...
I don't see it as a large-scale threat. Insofar as I said, basically have the David Horowitz crowd on one side collecting anecdotes about professors who are forcing their students to lobby governments for political activity. You have on the other side the sort of set of anecdotes about legislatures trying to impose an artificial force balance on biology departments, and I'm not aware of campaigns that have really gone very far in this respect. I don't think it's an ominous threat.
I guess I got out of law school in 1967, and the first thing I did was work on an amicus brief of the AAUP in the case of Whitehill versus Elkins, which is the last of the loyalty oath cases. Mm-hmm. Where the court sort of came full circle from genuflecting to the state's ability to command a loyalty oath, eventually to striking them down, but not on the merits, but on an alternative theory of vagueness or overbreath. And I do remember the palpable sense of fear that pervaded American campuses at that time. I guess I disagree with Brian on one account. We are given anecdotal evidence of bias or tendentiousness. That take that for what it's worth. I don't give it very much credit, although the report I drafted states that with 500,000 college professors teaching 7 or 9 million students, it is statistically inconceivable that there aren't some people somewhere who are just don't understand what the standards are. Mm. I don't think this characterizes the majority. On the other hand, the evidence about state action is not anecdotal. It's documented. There are 21 bills that have been introduced. They've had a legislative history. They've either passed or not passed. There are institutions that are adopting rules. I agree that I think it's premature. We're not living yet under anything like the regime of the 50s. Whether that will come about, I think, is historically contingent. The war on – if there's another terrorist attack, anything like what happened on 9/11. I don't know what the atmosphere on campus will be. Ohio has adopted a law that requires all public employees, including faculty members and teaching assistants in the public institutions in Ohio, to sign a statement that they are not associated with any terrorist group. They are not a member of any terrorist group. They do not affiliate with or support any terrorist group defined as a list promulgated by the president, and so on. I view that as a perhaps tepid but nevertheless chilling first step toward precisely the kind of regime that did chill American campuses in the late 40s and 50s.
Well, that isn't an academic classroom issue. I mean, it's a different sort of intervention. And certainly state legislators have a legitimate interest in the way the public universities in their own states are run. So, the fact that there's legislation doesn't immediately tell me that we must be alarmed. But you could go over the details.
The devil is in the details. The devil is in the nature of the mm-hmm. legislation itself. Giving equal time to specific creation is perhaps the reductio ad absurdum of legislative interference in what goes on in the classroom.
I do want to try to get at least one more caller in here in the time we have left, and we have just about 5 minutes. So let's go to Champaign County. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to correct the impression that Norman Finkelstein was. The question was inside of the academia, DePaul, a question of his academic qualifications, because and what he'd written, he was overwhelmingly accepted by his tenure committee. It was all outside pressure, which did hinge on the content. But inside the academic milieu, he was entirely appreciated there, and it was all the outside agitation. They had a conference. It is settled, but he's still speaking out. The last time he was bounced out of Harper Hunter College in New York, he went to the West Bank and Gaza and wrote a book about it. So I'm hoping something. At academicfreedomchicago.org, you can find the proceedings from last Thursday's In Defense of Academic Freedom conference that featured Noam Chomsky and John Mearsheimer and Finkelstein. So if people, and it's also a good portal to an entire panoply of sites preoccupied with academic freedom, where you can find maybe the chapter and verse on those legislative efforts. But I wanted to know about your response to the kind of structural undermining of academic freedom. We have the example of the Capitalism and Limited Government Institute, which I understand, last I heard of last Thursday, the Memorandum of Agreement with the Institute has some kind of restriction on circulation, and that even a professor in the business school wanted that to be made public, and I'm not sure if it's been made public yet. And that kind of lack of transparency is extremely pernicious to academic freedom, and it seems to me it's more of the structural problem. The first critic of that we had in this show actually offered the best reason for more insulation of academics from the funding, contrary to what he was proposing. So I'll leave it at that, since time's short. I may have eaten it up already. Thanks.
Well, we have maybe about a 2 minutes left, and I don't know how you want to respond.
Well, the Academy Fund issue is the current procedural status of it, as I understand it, is this. There was a memorandum of understanding signed July 20. There's been a lot of heat and protests surrounding it. The chancellor has appointed an advisory committee charged not only with looking at aspects of its implementation, but in fact charged with the larger question of whether the memorandum as currently configured is consistent with the university's commitments to academic freedom and institutional autonomy. I'm a member of that committee, and so it would be premature for me to discuss the committee's thinking. It's only met once. But fair to say, the question of whether of that enterprise will be housed within the university, and if so, in what fashion, is not at all settled.
Let me give an abstract answer. I think when academic freedom and donor intentions have arm wrestled in the past, academic freedom has generally won out. When donors have given money with the intention that it be applied for a very particular purpose, it very often ends up, in the sort of extreme example, someone sets up the Alexander Hamilton Center for the Study of Sexuality or something, because the money that was intended to be for the study of Alexander Hamilton gets pushed another way. Universities have been outstanding at taking money and using it for what they want to use it for. So I wouldn't fret a great deal that if there is a fund fundraising around the theme of capitalism, that means it's going to skew the university in a pro-market direction.
Well, let me just second, if we have a minute, what Brian said. Universities have been, in recent years, certainly since World War II, been pretty good about not accepting gifts with strings attached that would give the donor control over curriculum, teaching, or the lie. But it is not to say that those efforts don't continue and that eternal vigilance is not the price that we have to pay.
Well, we're going to have to stop at this point. I will do one mention again that there will be a panel discussion on this subject taking place on the U of I campus next Tuesday, October 23rd, over the noon hour in 319 Gregory Hall. Brian Gaines, one of our guests here this morning, will be taking place, taking part. Also, Carrie Nelson, who, along with Matthew Finken, a professor of law here at the U of I, was involved in this committee of the American Association of University Professors looking at this issue of academic freedom in the classroom, and they did issue a report. It came out about a month or so ago, and if you were interested in reading about it, I'm sure if you go to the website of the AAUP, you can read it there. And for people, again, here on the campus, if you're interested in this subject, you can stop by at noon, 319 Gregory Hall, next Tuesday, and be a participant in this panel discussion that will involve a number of people here. Again, our guest, Brian Gaines, a professor of political science, and Matthew Finken, he's professor of law here at the U of I. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.